Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a podcast about the rulers of the ancient Roman Empire. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Dr. Rhiannon Evans, a senior lecturer in ancient Mediterranean studies at La Trobe University. This is episode LXX, The Marco-Manic Wars. What is it good for? Absolutely nothing. With the Parthians once again defeated and the Antonine Plague sweeping through the empire, Marcus Aurelius must defend Rome from yet another opportunistic enemy. The tribes to the north, or as Rome called them, the barbarians. The northern borders were under threat from a rough coalition chiefly led by the Marcomanni, and Marcus heads out to take control of the Roman forces himself. It's a conflict that will dominate his attention for the rest of his life. Here's Rhiannon Evans.
The Marcomannic Wars really dominated the reign of Marcus Aurelius, and they started maybe late 166, early 167, were ongoing throughout the whole rest of his reign, right, until the time he died in 180. And they involved a group of peoples that we would now call Germanic or even German, who were moving south and forming more of an alliance than they had before. So previously they'd been kind of distinct peoples.
Combative tribes kind of things.
Yeah, so might have been more likely to fight against each other than to join together and fight against the Roman Empire. But who saw an opportunity in the mid-second century to extend their power southwards. And they were a few separate peoples, but the main one that we talk about is the Marcomanni.
So that was a specific tribe at the time?
That is a specific Germanic people.
Yeah. I shouldn't be using the word tribe by the sounds of it. You keep saying people.
I kind of prefer it, although I think it might be hyper PC.
All right.
The Romans would have regarded them as tribes, that's for sure.
Oh, well, okay. I'm in good company then. So the circumstances that you alluded to was the Parthian War, I suppose, that gave them an opportunity because of the lack of the troops in the area.
Yes, that certainly helps. Troops have been drawn down to the other end of the empire to deal with issues in the Mesopotamian area in the Middle East. It's kind of often seen as a longer-term malaise for the Romans, though, in that, of course, this is what will finish them off eventually, a good two centuries later. But the movements of the Germanic tribes are starting to sort of heat up at this point. And this is where their future doom is going to come from.
Yeah.
And so any opportunity whereby the border is weakened in any way means that there will be trouble from the north. And remember that there had always been a kind of fear of the Germanic peoples on the part of the Romans. And in fact, Augustus himself, although we think of him as somebody who really consolidated the borders and just stopped, he had an ambition to conquer large parts of, I guess, northern and western Germany. Remember, there are actually provinces in what we think of Germanic territories, which are Noricum and Pannonia and Upper and Lower Germany. They're pretty small. Most of Germany never gets conquered. Augustus wanted to extend that border, but that was an ambition that he never got to realize. The Romans never did well there. They never did well, really, over the Rhine and over the Danube.
Yeah, yeah. And is that basically what defines the edge of the Roman territory up there, those two rivers?
Well, the Danube no longer does because Trajan has gone over the Danube
conquer
Dacia.
Yeah.
And the Romans do have some territories the other side of the Rhine. So not quite, but almost.
Okay.
Yeah, if you can think of, broadly speaking, those two mighty European rivers as being at the edge of Roman territory. And the Romans feel that what is beyond there is kind of really tough, feisty barbarians.
Yeah,
it's a bit like what's beyond Hadrian's Wall, I guess.
So they drew a dragon on the map and just left it to its own devices.
Yeah, unfortunately we don't have any of their actual maps, but I think they might have done, or at least some really fierce-looking guy.
Yeah.
Hairy and probably woad-covered.
So is the term Marcomannic Wars an accurate one, or is it just a handy, convenient one that we use now?
It's a bit of an inaccurate blanket term, but it makes sense because the Marcomanni really, especially the king of the Marcomanni, are the ones who do bind this loose alliance together.
Okay.
So it does involve other Germanic peoples. So it involves the Sarmati and the Iarzyges and what we might call the Vandals as well.
I heard the Quadi.
And also the Quadi will be involved. These are all really fun terms to say.
Yeah.
But if you want to put them all in a list every time, and they're not all involved in every single battle either, but the kind of center point, the hub of all of this, I was going to call it an uprising, but it's not really, because these people aren't part of the Roman Empire. This incursion, I suppose.
The migration.
Is the Marcomanni. Yeah. They're the ones at the center of it.
Okay. So in antiquity, pre the Antonines, how did Rome deal with this area? You say that there was a lot of distinct individual tribes. Was it a strategy of keeping them squabbling amongst themselves so that they're busy?
Well, there were various ways of dealing with it. What Caesar did was to go over the Rhine and show them that he could do that. He could build bridges and he could go over there and fight them.
Yeah.
Where Caesar goes is a lot further west, though, than what we're actually talking about now, because this is kind of vast northern and eastern Europe, which they just think of generally as being the Germani and maybe the Scythians if you get far enough up. So that was a kind of show of strength. That, by this point, of course, is over 200 years previously.
Mm.
Then they also, under Augustus in particular, they kind of formulate these small provinces along the Rhine, kind of as a buffer. So, for example, Noricum and Pannonia are approximately modern Switzerland and Austria, maybe into Hungary a little bit. And they also do what they do everywhere, which is they have client kings. Mm. So they kind of have agreements with various peoples in these danger areas that they will recognize Rome as the main power. They don't have to be ruled by them, but they will kind of acquiesce to them. A lot of people make parallels with the modern world with the way that we treat the United States, which might not have an empire as such, but has a kind of authority over a lot of the Western world. So they've got client kings there. And in fact, the main thrust of this war on the Marcomanni side, the King Balabar, he is a client king of Rome.
Yes, so the main agitator, the one who causes all the trouble. Okay, let's go with that then. So how did this war start then? Lack of troops thanks to the Parthian War. And it pretty much starts as the Parthian War is winding down, doesn't it?
Yes, I know. Poor old Marcus Aurelius just never gets a minute to himself.
So he has a triumph, but he's got in the back of my mind, I've got to go up north and deal with the Marcomanni.
Yes, and as I say, we don't know whether it's late 166 or early 167, but during this period, there is general unrest, and it's actually related to a few things, such as the desire to migrate south into Europe and almost market opportunities, things you might not expect, especially if you think of these people as rough barbarians, as the Romans did. But they want more rights, kind of rights to buy into the Roman Empire. So different forms of tribute, you know, to be taxed as Roman citizens are, for example, or at least empire citizens, to not have their tribute increased all the time. Because if you're a client king, then you are paying some tribute to the Roman Empire. And because of this agitation, these people see, well, there's unrest here. There's people who are dissatisfied. This is a time for us to bond together, which might have been difficult in the past because there are local rivalries. And it seems like Balomar, who is the king of the Marcomanni, the client king, sees this opportunity to form the coalition.
Mm.
This means that he's got enough power to cross over into Roman territory, into the province of Pannonia.
So are Rome in a position to mount a defence to this kind of incursion?
Well, they have troops there already because this is a border province.
Yeah.
And they've crossed the Danube River along with 6,000 troops, which is a fair number.
The Marcomanni.
The Marcomanni have and their allies.
Yeah.
And they get fought back by the local Roman militia there.
But this is seen as enough of a problem to have to deal with it.
Yeah. So you kind of have to have a diplomatic summit now to make sure that the Germans don't come back over the Danube. And the Romans and the leaders of these Germanic peoples get together. And Balamar is now in a position, I guess quite a powerful position, because he's kind of the intermediary between Rome and these Germanic peoples.
He actually runs it on behalf of the Romans.
Yeah, exactly, because he's a client king.
That's a mad position to be in.
So he's kind of able to bridge them. And in a way, it looks like he's sort of changing sides. He's been at the head of this alliance And now he's the one saying, oh, well, we on the Roman side want to make peace with you. We want to mediate.
I like the thought that he's sitting down at this big table on one side with the Marcomanni, and then he runs around to the other side and sits down with the Romans, and then he runs around to the other side and sits down with the Marcomanni. So that's how it goes back and forth.
It's like he's playing tennis with himself or something. He's sitting in the middle of the table. So he sort of looks like he is the join between them at the same time that he's been the cause of the rift, which is very strange. However, while this is going on, we get other northern tribes, the Vandals and the Azyges, invading Dacia, the Roman province created by Trajan.
So they saw an opportunity there.
Yeah, so there's this general idea amongst the peoples beyond the Danube that there is weakness in the Roman Empire and this is the time to attack. And I suppose this is one of the reasons, just backtracking, why some people accuse Antoninus Pius of doing nothing while this was brewing up in the background, of not anticipating. It's very easy to say after the fact.
Yeah. But there is a general weakness, especially in the area, because you've got the plague going through the Roman troops. You've got them very distracted by the Parthian War. It's very opportunistic.
Well, one of the things that happens a couple of times during, especially the early part of these breaches, as it were, of the Roman frontier, is that the troops who come over will kill the governor.
Yeah.
So they'll kill the proconsul, which is an incredibly provocative thing to do. They get a long way down as well. They get all the way down into Greece and steal treasures. These are people who have taken that opportunity of a distraction slightly further west to come and really just gather booty, which of course is what the Romans have been doing all along.
Yeah.
And now it's happening the other way around.
So this is almost separate to what's going on with the Marcomanni, or it's been collectively gathered together into this one war, I suppose. So I take it the peace talks are successful to some extent.
And they sort of have to be, because now with the plague really taking hold in Rome, the Romans are kind of hamstrung temporarily. So they need to just mediate and keep things quiet.
So now we get to the point where Marcus Aurelius is going to have some kind of imperial response to this, maybe not with the Marcomanni to start with, but with the Azyghi and the Vandals making their opportunistic plunge across the Danube there. So what goes on with Marcus Aurelius? What's his response?
Towards the end of 168, so we're, you know, about a year and a half into this now, perhaps, or a year, he and Lucius Verus leave to go north with two legions. So they want to make sure that even though everyone's kind of back in their place for the moment, they need to make sure that they can shore up the border there and that they can sort out any oncoming trouble. So I guess Marcus Aurelius and Lucius Verus are trying to do what Antoninus Pius didn't do, which is to try and anticipate further trouble. It's a bit like Caesar going over the Rhine all those centuries earlier. When you see the oncoming army, you keep away. Remember, Caesar went over to stop the Germans helping the Gauls.
Yeah.
And when Marcus Aurelius and Lucius Verus approach with these two legions, the Marcomanni withdraw.
So simply just the intimidation at that point.
They just need to be there. But it's not the end of it.
I find it interesting that at this point, and unlike the Parthian War, Marcus Aurelius sees the need to go and see to this in person and take Lucius Verus with him. So you don't have one sitting back in Rome managing everything. You've got both of them going to meet the Marcomanni. I can see a couple of possibilities. One is that he didn't trust Lucius Verus enough to get the job done by himself.
Interesting.
Maybe. And the other is that he's gone, I really need some sort of military experience myself because I'm lacking in that as an emperor. I'm going to go forward and meet this threat.
Yeah, I like those theories. Yeah. I mean, the not trusting Lucius Verus would certainly have the Augustan history agreeing with you because they destroy his reputation, don't they?
Yeah.
And even after he's dead, they say nasty things about him. The other may well be true in that, remember that Marcus Aurelius was sort of embarrassed by all of the honours that he's given over the Parthian conflict, which largely, even though Lucius Verus apparently didn't do very much there, he was the person who went there as emperor. And maybe he feels that he has to actually take part in war to be worthy of all these titles the Senate keeps throwing at him.
Well, regardless, and speculation aside, two emperors go north, one comes back.
Yes, Lucius Verus doesn't last very long. He dies the following year. When Marcus Aurelius came close to the action, they realized that there wasn't actually much fighting going on, and Verus decided that he wanted to return to Rome, but Marcus Aurelius apparently is the one who wanted to keep going.
Mm.
However, while they were traveling, Verus was hit by a very sudden illness. And so that actually determined that they did return to Rome because Verus died and his body had to be brought back to the city. Now, there's plague around, so it probably is plague, but there are some theories that it might have been something else because it was so sudden that it might have been a stroke. And you'll read various accounts. It's always very difficult to know what ancient texts are telling us because their ideas of disease were so different from our own. So Lucius is buried in the mausoleum of Hadrian. And so, you know, he's kind of started out on this journey and has had to withdraw. So the Augustan history, The Life of Marcus Aurelius, says, and I quote at this point, "While rendering thanks to the Senate for deifying his brother," that is Lucius Verus, "Marcus covertly indicated that all the war plans by which the Parthians were overcome had been his own. Besides this, he made a further statement in which he indicated that now at last he would govern the Republic, as it were, from afresh, now that the person who seemed rather neglectful had been removed." So this is what I mean by saying the Augustan history has a go at Lucius Verus.
Has it in for him, does it?
Even just describing what happened after his death.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem to fit with anything else that we know about the character of Marcus Aurelius, I have to say.
Yeah,
that he's quite modest and isn't interested in being in the limelight and is quite happy for Lucius Verus to have it. So unless something else is going on and people have said no one had confidence in Lucius Verus, you have to show that you're now in control, I don't really trust this. But it's interesting and it's very soap opera-y.
So one thing that Marcus Aurelius does before he heads north again is that he rather quickly has his daughter remarried. Now, his daughter was first married to Lucius Verus. 3 children, all died very young though. But she's still got good lineage, I suppose.
Yes, and she's married off to Claudius Pompeianus very, very quickly, as you say. Normally there is a
mourning period.
Yeah, as in many modern societies. And he's not of the aristocracy. He is an equestrian. He's from the class of the Roman knights. So high-born, but not the very highest. And so quite an unexpected choice.
Mm.
But he will turn out to be someone who takes part in the war that's ongoing and plays an important part in that.
Quite a bit older than her as well.
Yeah, that's not unknown.
Yeah.
We've seen that time and time again, I think.
Would this have been I need the support of the military, I'm going to marry her to this man?
Seems not unlikely, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yes.
And there's a kind of adjustment going on, I suppose, whereby previously emperors have married the women in their families, especially their daughters, to other significant families to get them on side, senatorial families. And now it's the military who need to be incorporated into the imperial family.
So with his brother now buried and him being the sole emperor, Marcus Aurelius still has a Marcomannic problem to deal with. So he heads north again, doesn't he? 168.
Yeah, and this time instead of Lucius Verus, he takes Lucilla's new husband.
His new son-in-law.
Yeah, Claudius Pompeianus. So yeah. it's like a direct replacement, both in terms of the military colleague and husband for daughter.
Yes. What's their intention then?
It's pretty much the same as before. It's to take care of the northern barbarians who'd crossed the Danube and killed the governor. In other words, the Iazarges, who have actually killed another Roman governor in the meantime.
Yeah.
So you keep replacing them and they just chop them down.
That's the worst job advertisement ever.
It's a bit dangerous being up there at this point. So you've kind of got this push and pull going on that because they're going sort of northeast, we find that the other peoples along the border use this opportunity to push south as well. So pretty much all along the Danube, you've got trouble at this point.
It is a very long border along the north of the Roman Empire.
Which is why they need to make these little alliances with peoples across the other side and need to make sure that they're kept satisfied.
Yeah.
And according to Dio, it seems as though the barbarians had women fighting with them because he says that there were women's bodies dressed in armor found there. So that's quite interesting. And of course, another reason the Romans would find them barbaric. And over on the eastern side, you've got another tribe with a great name, the Costobochi. I think that might be my favorite one.
That's a good one.
They come over the Danube and they're over the side that we would now regard as Greece. They cross over into that area. It's called Thrace. and they come through that area, through the Balkans, all the way to Athens, just outside Athens, where you have the Eleusinian Mysteries. And they actually knock down the temple of the Eleusinian Mysteries. And this is really symbolic. I don't know whether they realized this, but this is a very ancient mystery cult. And remember, Hadrian had been enrolled into this cult, something that the Roman emperors have respect for. And they're kind of destroying Greek heritage, Greek culture, something that is very sacred to the Romans too.
Mm.
This is a big problem for the Romans, this huge incursion, and that far south as Athens, would be terrifying to them.
But it becomes an even bigger problem because meanwhile in the West...
Well, Balamar, the big problem guy, and his Marcomanni and the people that he's made alliances with in the Germanic territories, he comes over the Danube and he defeats a huge Roman army of 20,000 men near a place called Carnutum. This is a terrible disaster for the Romans in that they don't expect to be defeated by barbarians when it happens.
Let alone it's being such a big defeat. That's massive.
Yeah, this is a terrible disaster. Another big landmark is that now the Marcomanni make their way into Italy. Right, so Italy has been safe for generations, in fact, for hundreds of years. And the last time a foreign army, and I say foreign advisedly, because of course the Romans have led armies into Italy in the meantime.
Yes.
Civil wars have happened. But the last time a foreign army has come over the Alps into Italy was in 101 BCE when the Gauls came down and were defeated eventually by Marius. They've had wars everywhere all over the Mediterranean in the meantime, but they've never had to worry about troops from another people coming into Italy. And this would have really shocked the Romans. They get into northern Italy. So they raise one city to the ground, Oderzo, and they besiege another, Aquileia, which is kind of in the region of Venice, up in the northeast of Italy there. The general Furius Victorianus, he's got the name Victory, Victorianus, tries to save Aquileia, but he's defeated and Furius himself is killed. So now Pompeianus, remember Marcus Aurelius's son-in-law, is sent off to relieve the city, along with a man called Pertinax, who will eventually be emperor briefly, but that's for the future, and he drives Balamar into retreat.
This seems to be very much on the defensive.
Yeah, it's kind of last gasp stuff.
Yeah, but the entire campaign up to this point has been totally reacting to what the Marcomanni, the Quadi, and whatever other tribe wants to come up against Rome.
Yeah, reactive is exactly the word I had in mind. It's as if they're always a step behind what the Marcomanni and the other peoples are up to, and they're always having to respond to attacks. So they need to kind of get on the attack themselves.
Yeah.
And that's why Marcus Aurelius now takes troops and marches them across the Danube to take the fight into their territory.
So there's two quite notable events that I found in amongst the literature here, which one is more well-known than the other one. But there are two miracles attributed to this campaign.
Marcus Aurelius goes across the Danube in 172, and it's either that year or the following year that we have the miracle of the rain. And this is a battle where Roman troops are surrounded by the Quadi. You know, Roman legions have names, and this is the 12th Legion, who are called the Fulminata, the Thundering Legion.
Good name.
The Fulminata. Yeah, Fulminata sounds frightening. Yeah. They're thundering, they're roaring. This is a terrible situation because they run out of water. It's not that they've been defeated, but they might have to surrender and be overcome by the Quadi just because they can't survive. And at that moment, a heavy shower came down and relieves the Romans. So they get water from the skies, from the heavens. Dio claims that this is divine inspired, not unexpected, it would be read like that, and that an Egyptian priest had prayed to Mercury. Interesting that it's Mercury and not Jupiter, who is the sky god, but anyway. Later Christian authors would claim that they were praying to the Christian god.
Oh, right. Which
seems extremely unlikely at this point.
No Christians in the Roman army?
There wouldn't be many.
Yeah.
They'd be pretty underground.
It only takes one to pray.
I guess so. It's interesting that the supernatural is being brought back into events, and this is a very broad comment, but this is often seen as a period where spirituality is becoming more important,
yeah.
and it is actually a direct connection with the divine. You've got to be careful because some of this is read back onto the fact that we know that Marcus Aurelius was a very spiritual character because we found his works, his meditations. But as we've said before, nobody knew about them at the time. They were hidden away and they were only found 100 years after his death. Mm. So whether he was one of the few kind of thinking in this way or whether this is a sign of the times, it's hard to know.
So as a sidebar, he was probably writing that around this point, isn't he?
He was certainly writing the first book of the Meditations. He actually mentions the Quaddi in the subtitle. That's what he's doing with his evenings on campaign.
Yeah. All right, so that's a miracle of rain, but there's also a miracle of lightning, and it might just be easy enough to read out that Historia Augusta quote.
Yeah, the Historia Augusta tells us about the miracle of the lightning, which is somewhat more dramatic. In the life of Marcus Aurelius, chapter 24, in the lightning miracle was inspired by the emperor who summoned a thunderbolt from heaven against a siege engine of the enemy by means of his prayers. So they were under siege. Marcus Aurelius apparently prays for help. And the help is that the siege engine is struck by lightning,
yeah.
which is extremely lucky. Both of these events are actually depicted in image form as well on the column of Marcus Aurelius, which has relief sculpture going up it. And two of the very dramatic events are these two miracles. You get to see this big beardy figure with his arms outstretched and all the rain coming down for the miracle of the rain. The Romans were really affected by the weather and what's happening, and in two good ways there with these miracles. But on a more regular basis, they were dealing with really harsh conditions caused by extreme cold. And they seem to be fighting during the winter as well, which is not normal for Roman campaigns. So we know that they actually fought one battle on the Danube when it was iced over.
Wow.
Which is a terrifying thought. How do you fight on ice?
Yeah.
And another battle during the height of summer, which in Central Europe can be quite punishing just to walk around in, let alone to fight in. But on the big central plains of Europe, they were fighting in extreme heat. So it was really tough for the Roman and the Germanic troops, this war, and it must have been fairly brutal.
It's rather fitting that the Marcomanni started this war because they saw an opportunity. There was a lack of troops thanks to the Parthian War. Why not try and get some better territory further south across the Danube? And while Marcus Aurelius is busy in the north meeting the Marcomanni, somebody over east sees their own opportunity.
Yeah, the governor of Syria is proclaimed emperor. This is a man called Avidius Cassius.
Now, he was a hero of the Parthian War as well.
He was a hero to his troops, which puts him in a strong position. This is a worry for every emperor. So Marcus Aurelius has to kind of abandon his campaign on the northern frontier and go and deal with this threat to his power. So we kind of put the Marcomannic Wars on hold for a while.
Yeah.
While he goes and puts out another fire somewhere else.
Yeah.
Poor Marcus Aurelius, he never gets to rest. I'm amazed he had time to write his Meditations. But he will come back further north towards the end of his life.
That's Dr. Rhiannon Evans, Senior Lecturer in Ancient Mediterranean Studies at La Trobe University. And you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe in iTunes. Please review us or give us a rating. The feedback is appreciated. You can like Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow both myself and Rhiannon on Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans, and I'm at Nightlight Guy. In the next episode of Emperors of Rome, we look at the writings of Marcus Aurelius in the form of the Meditations. But until then, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.